Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. More than 1 million people are living with HIV in the United States today. And though the movement for HIV/AIDS gained major ground and saw many victories in the 80s and 90s, today the disease affects a diverse set of people. Blacks account for more new HIV infections and HIV-related deaths than any other group in the country. And in many communities of color, HIV still goes largely unacknowledged. According to a recent New York Times article, nationally, 25% of new infections are in Black and Hispanic men. So on today's Your Call, we're going to look back at the history of activism that created the first wave of HIV/AIDS awareness and then talk about the current state of the struggle. Sean Stroob has been involved since the beginning. Sean was active with the People with AIDS Coalition New York in the mid-80s, co-chaired the fundraising committee for ACT UP New York in the late 80s, and in 1990 became the first openly HIV-positive person to run for Congress. He's the founder of PAWS Magazine, the leading independent global source of information about HIV. And in 2010, he co-founded the Positive Justice Project and is producing a documentary called HIV is Not a Crime. It's about HIV criminalization in the United States. Sean is out with a new book about the movement and his life. It's called Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. And Sean joins me here in studio. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Nana Khanna. She serves as executive director for the Positive Women's Network. It's a national membership body of over 2,500 HIV-positive women, inclusive of transgender women, and it advocates for policies and programs reflecting the needs of women affected by HIV. Nana was appointed to President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS in 2010, and she was diagnosed with HIV in 2002. Hi, Nana. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So I was kind of surprised, maybe I shouldn't be, but AIDS doesn't get obviously as much attention as it did in the 80s and 90s. But Sean, you say that the stigma today is even worse than it was back then.
Sure, it is worse. But most people think of stigma when you mention AIDS-related stigma. They first think of their own fear of casual contagion. And most people are more sophisticated, and we know more about the real routes and risks of HIV transmission. So the fear of casual contagion has gone down, but that's only one component of stigma. Stigma is also prejudgment. It's marginalization. It's self-stigmatization. And in those measures, I think most people with HIV would agree that the stigma is worse today. Disclosure is more difficult today. The consequences are more challenging.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, when someone discloses their HIV status, they're not disclosing it just to the person they tell. They're disclosing it to that person and everyone else that person tells. There are risks with disclosure, including loss of employment and housing. For a lot of people in relationships that can be abusive, there's a risk of physical violence. There was a woman in Houston shot and killed by her boyfriend not very long ago, and he told the police, she was killing me, so I killed her. One of the reasons many women are reluctant to disclose is fear of losing custody of their children. So in the old days, when someone tested positive, they were connected with a network of people with HIV. They were called Body Positive or the People with AIDS Coalition or Being Alive. And it was through that network and that mutual support that people learned how to disclose and build a support network around themselves. Well, the support for those networks and the funding for those networks is gone for the most part, and people are tested routinely and popped out onto the sidewalk. Their world has been turned upside down. They're in a state of semi-shock often, and they're expected to begin disclosing their HIV status right away, and it just isn't that easy.
Nana, what do you hear about stigma in the communities you work with?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Sean said. I think it's important to understand that, you know, as the epidemic has become more racialized, more feminized, more impoverished, it's no coincidence that stigma has increased. You know, stigma is not only about HIV. People with HIV are often living at the intersection of multiple identities, whether it's, you know, being a person of color, being a poor person, being a current or former substance user, being somebody with mental health issues, being gay. You know, there are kind of a whole range of things that are likely to put people at risk for acquiring HIV. And so the stigma is not only about HIV, it's about a whole set of identities. And I think we see that play out in a whole lot of different ways, including the fact that that HIV and AIDS doesn't get talked about so much anymore, because it's not just, you know, it's affecting a whole set of people that tend to have less access to privilege and less access to power, to media, and a whole set of institutions to back them.
And Sean, do you think that's the main reason why we don't talk as much about AIDS?
Well, there, yes, it's the main reason. Yes, I would say is where the epidemic has settled into communities that have a whole host of challenges, where AIDS has to sort of get in line with the hierarchy of burdens of oppression, as opposed to the very visible activism in the 1980s. The people thought principally of urban dwelling. Middle and upper middle class gay white men they saw on TV that for whom AIDS was a singular challenge. And of course, when combination therapy came out in the mid 90s and people were no longer in as desperate a struggle for survival, much of that activism went away. So AIDS work cannot be separated from the other issues of racism and sexism and homophobia and you know the whole list that Nana cited.
What are your thoughts on that, Nana? Why is it that we don't talk about AIDS as much as we used to? I mean, on AIDS Day, we talk about it, and then February 7th, in just a couple of days next week, it's Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day.
I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, I think some of them are the reasons that we've been talking about. So, you know, people with HIV now have, in many ways, have more to lose by disclosing and by coming out. For a set of reasons. One is because HIV is now, if you have access to appropriate care and treatment, is a chronic manageable condition. It's no longer something you need to die from. So people can expect to live a long time, to be in the workforce for a long time, to want to partner, to want to have families. And so, you know, there can be a lot more to lose by coming out and disclosing in that way. But also, when you're talking about folks who are really dependent on, you know, on certain kinds of jobs or access to certain kinds of housing, and a set of benefits and a set of social structures, there's a lot more to lose by coming out and being open about your HIV status. But I think another reason is really another reason that it's really not talked about as much is really that it is more a chronic, manageable condition now and can be. And so people don't see it as such an urgent sort of issue, which is a problem because there are a whole set of issues that have been created over the last three decades that kind of uniquely apply to people with HIV and also that the systems and institutions that have been set up to deal with HIV are uniquely positioned to meet healthcare needs really well. And so so there's an opportunity to also look at those as examples of success.
And Sean, you started or co-founded the Positive Justice Project, and you're working to repeal HIV criminalization statutes. Currently, there are 32 states and 2 U.S. territories that explicitly criminalize HIV exposure through sex, shared needles, and in some jurisdictions, through, quote, bodily fluids, including saliva.
Right.
These are on the books today.
Well, HIV criminalization is a phenomenon where one's HIV positive status is used inappropriately in a criminal prosecution. About 2/3 of the states have these HIV-specific statutes, laws that only apply to people with HIV, creating a different criminal law for people based on an immutable characteristic, something most people think is a bad idea when that immutable characteristic is one's gender or sexual orientation or skin color or physical ability or disability or genetic makeup. But here we are creating a viral underclass in the law around one highly stigmatized virus. More women in the U.S. died last year of cervical cancer from human papillomavirus than died of AIDS from HIV, yet we aren't creating these HPV-specific statutes. So as a consequence, in addition to the HIV-specific statutes, in every state, there are examples of the HIV status being used inappropriately in a prosecution. So, for example, Texas and New York do not have HIV-specific statutes, but there's a man, Willie Campbell, serving 35 years in Texas for spitting at a cop. And New York State David Plunkett, just a year ago, got out of prison after serving 6.5 years for spitting when an appeals court in New York finally ruled that saliva could not be considered a deadly weapon in New York. In other places, people have been charged under bioterrorism statutes. Mm-hmm. These laws are not about whether or not there was HIV transmission. They're not about whether or not there was a risk of HIV transmission. They're not even about exposure, which is the language often used in the statutes. They are about perceived exposure. They are about stigma. They are about misunderstandings, misconceptions about the real routes, risks, and consequences of HIV transmission. And they usually boil down to the disclosure cases. Usually boil down to whether or not the person with HIV can prove that they had disclosed in advance.
And I think, you know, you were asking about why is this happening, and we're seeing definitely an increase in criminalization cases, but also an increase in other kinds of stigmatizing treatment of people living with HIV by law enforcement, for example. There was a case in Dearborn, Michigan last year where a woman was riding in a car and was pulled over during a routine traffic stop. And when the officer found out that there were HIV medications in the glove box, he basically, you know, kind of increased the charges against her and said, you should have told me you had HIV. I've put myself at risk. I should have been wearing gloves. And, totally stigmatized her and treated her really badly. And so she's now filed a federal case. She's brought this to federal court and just filed the case earlier this week. But I think part of the issue is that we have a whole system that's not dealing with HIV. So we have law enforcement officers who don't have basic information about how HIV is transmitted. And, you know, you can't get it in a traffic stop, by the way, or by or by someone spitting on you, or, you know, even really by biting you, or, you know, a whole range of things that people are so kind of afraid of. And it's really alarming that this this set of people that are really charged with protecting the health and the rights of communities in our country are so poorly informed.
Mm. Sean.
Well, and also, you know, while the overall media coverage about the epidemic has declined precipitously, and most of the coverage these days is generally around some property interest, a drug development issue or something like that, there is a lot of coverage and growing coverage of these criminalization cases that is often hysterical, race-driven, mm-hmm. Where they're talking about AIDS monsters and AIDS predators and 300 people potentially infected, and these wildly ridiculous sort of coverage. And, you know, since the combination therapy came out and it made it possible for people with HIV to live normal lifespans, the perspective, the view of people with HIV has changed from an expectation that we're going to die horrific deaths sometime soon to increasingly being seen through this prism of our potential to infect others as inherently dangerous. The criminal justice system and the public health system have increasingly viewed people with HIV as a dangerous population to be sought out, identified, tested, tagged, reported, tracked, regulated, controlled. And this is obviously a very frightening trend. Every person with HIV in the U.S. is now one disgruntled ex-partner away from finding themselves in a courtroom.
Well, how is this happening today? Do you think it's because there's this lack of awareness? I mean, I keep thinking about your book, Sean, and, you know, you go back to the 70s and go back to your childhood in Iowa City and moving to Washington and getting involved in New York. Are you sometimes shocked that you still have to talk about it like this?
I'm not sure shocked, frustrated, disappointed. But, you know, it is a problem so intertwined with all sorts of other problems in society that we choose to turn our heads from and look the other way. And, you know, we live in a political environment where the solution to everything is to lock people up. Mm-hmm. You know, these statutes are not only imposing injustice on people with HIV, you know, decades for spitting or decades even when somebody has an undetectable viral load and uses a condom. They're also terrible public health policy because you can't get prosecuted if you don't know you are positive. Most new infections come from people who have not been tested, who do not know they are positive.
Wow. Yeah, and I think it is so important to just put this in context. So, you know, we have defunding of comprehensive sex education mm-hmm. happening all over the country, so people don't have basic information. We have a racist criminal justice system, and so, of course, that plays out in any criminalization case. You know, the same kind of racial inequities that we say play out in other situations. And I, you know, I definitely don't want to miss this important point that Sean is making about we have science now that shows that if people with HIV are virally suppressed, we are much less likely to transmit HIV. And this has been a major advancement in our understanding of the virus and of transmission. But that information is very well accepted in the medical community, and there have been large-scale trials to show this. That information has not percolated out into, it has not changed policies, for example, around criminalization. It has not changed programs. A lot of people living with HIV don't have this information, and I think that's a clear reflection of stigma and sort of the stigmatizing of sexuality and reproduction of people living with HIV. A lot of providers are not communicating this information to their clients. The Positive Women's Network did a survey last year of 179 women living with HIV looking at sexual and reproductive health issues. And one of the questions we asked them was whether they had been told by a provider that if their viral load was suppressed, they were less likely to transmit HIV. I mean, this is a big deal. You know, many times people with HIV, our motivation is to protect others. And particularly for women, you know, a lot of times our motivation is to protect our partners or our children or our unborn children. And so having that knowledge that, that if your viral load is suppressed, you're less likely to transmit is a really big deal. It can change, you know, the way that you choose to interact. We found that over half of the women in our study who were almost all engaged in medical care, many of whom were virally suppressed, had not heard that from a medical provider.
Wow.
And this is similar to earlier in the epidemic, you know, when we did an article in PAS about how little risk there is, even before combination therapy, of women transmitting this virus to men in the U.S., call it the myth of the killer vagina. We found all sorts of women who believed they had infected their husbands who had previously died, when in fact it was generally the reverse.
Virally suppressed, can you talk more about that, and how does that work?
Yeah, basically, if you are HIV positive and you're on medication and your medication is working, one of the ways that we evaluate whether the medication is working is whether the copies of virus in your blood actually go down. So basically go down below a level that they can be detected by testing. And so they go down to a certain below 50 or below 75 copies in your blood, and then they can't be picked up in the test. And that means that's basically how they define suppression of your virus, effective suppression of your virus. And a large study that was done, the results of which were released, I think, in 2010, HPTN052, basically looked at about 3,000 couples with HIV who were what's called serodiscordant, where one is HIV positive and the other is HIV negative. Most of them were heterosexual, so we don't know exactly how well the findings apply outside of that, but we're pretty sure they're a good indication. And basically found that the chances of transmission when the HIV positive partner's viral load was suppressed, was undetectable, below the level where it can be detected, were close to zero.
Yeah.
They approach zero.
In fact,
even if a condom is not used.
Even if a condom is not used.
When there are no other things going on, you know, when there are no other sores present, syphilis, herpes sores, things that would make it more likely for the virus to be transmitted. Even if a condom is not used, an HIV positive partner is almost completely unlikely to transmit the virus during unprotected sex with an suppressed viral load.
And that HTPN052 study showed a 96% reduction in transmission risk. However, if you discount the first couple of months of the trial, when people had started treatment and were not yet fully suppressed, the reduction was 100%. There is not yet a single documented proven case of sexual transmission of HIV from someone who has an undetectable viral load. It may be possible. We know that people with a very low viral load have transmitted before, but there's not yet a documented case of someone with an undetectable viral load. And in fact, I think yesterday was the sixth anniversary of something called the Swiss Statement, which was the Swiss Federal AIDS Commission 6 years ago, very courageously, and they were attacked for this. They examined all the literature on transmission between serodiscordant couples. And they came to the conclusion that if there are no other sexually transmitted infections present in the relationship, and the person who is positive has been undetectable for at least 6 months, and the couple was monogamous, that they did not need to use condoms. And this was widely criticized, but they pointed out, it was a unanimous opinion from the Swiss Federal AIDS Commission, they pointed out that the science supporting their position was vastly more developed than the science supporting what is clearly true and widely accepted, which is that saliva cannot transmit HIV.
That is Sean Stroop. He's been involved with AIDS activism since the early days. He co-chaired the fundraising committee for ACT UP New York in the late 80s and 1990, became the first openly HIV-positive person to run for U.S. Congress, and he tells his stories about the movement and his life in Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. And tonight, Sean will be at Bookshop Santa Cruz, 1520 Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz at 7 o'clock, and then tomorrow he will be at the LGBT Center in San Francisco in the Rainbow Room, 1800 Market at Octavia, and that's from 7 to 9. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Nana Khanna. She's Executive Director for the Positive Women's Network. This is a group of over 2,500 HIV-positive women, and they advocate for policies reflecting the needs of women affected by HIV. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. If you are part of the beginning of the movement for HIV/AIDS awareness, what do you remember? What really stands out for you? How far have we come? If you are HIV positive or know someone who is and you'd like to share your experiences, we'd love to hear from you. And what can be done to really erase these stigmas and just raise awareness about very basic information? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Sean, what was it like for you to revisit this movement in the late 70s and the 80s when you wrote your book? I mean, you tell so many great stories. What was it like to go back to that time?
It was challenging. I mean, for one, you learn how unreliable one's own memory is. And I went back and sought out people I hadn't talked to in years and years, and I looked at contemporaneous news reports and made these charts and calendars. I found it therapeutic. I found I learned much more about myself than I expected. You know, I kind of went into this as a task. I was going to tell these stories. I didn't realize what it would mean for me. I enjoyed, there's a lot of, wonderful anecdotes in the book about getting Tennessee Williams to sign the first fundraising letter for the Human Rights Campaign and things with Gore Vidal and Keith Haring and Andy Warhol. So I've sort of all that in my youth were very important people and icons of the culture at the time, and seeing how they interacted with the epidemic and the LGBT community was kind of fun to go back and revisit. It was also cathartic. You know, it was, for a long time I'd resisted writing about the epidemic, and then, it suddenly dawned on me that someone has to be the memory, and that there are fewer and fewer of us alive to tell the story firsthand from the earliest days. And if we don't tell our stories, if we don't witness, if we don't remember the friends we lost, who can we expect will do that?
Sean Stroop is author of Body Counts. We're also joined by Nana Khanna. She's executive director for the Positive Women's Network. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the past, present, and future of HIV/AIDS activism. 1 million people are living with HIV in the United States today. So what will it take to raise awareness about just these very basic things we've been talking about and also erase stigma? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call on local public radio KALW. To join in today's conversation, the number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices. If you prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can simply leave a comment at that same website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say, and following that at noon, Bina, here on KALW San Francisco, 91.7 FM.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with the nation's sports writer Dave Zirin and the Washington Post's Kathy Lally. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the Super Bowl, the most watched sporting event in the U.S., with advertisers paying up to $4 million for 30-second spots. We'll also talk about protests at the Brazil World Cup, and thousands of migrant workers are organizing in Sochi, Russia. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about HIV activism. So much of it happened in the 80s. There were so many victories. A lot of major ground was gained. But today things are still pretty bad. There's a huge stigma. There's criminalization. As we just heard, a lot of basic information is not being shared with the public. So why is that? We'll talk about how policies actually affect this information from getting out. Today we're joined by Sean Strube. He's been involved since the beginning. In 1990, he became the first openly HIV-positive person to run for U.S. Congress. In 2010, he co-founded the Positive Justice Project and produced a documentary, HIV is Not a Crime. It's about HIV criminalization in the U.S. His new book is Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. And he'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz tonight at 7, 1520 Pacific Avenue, and tomorrow at the LGBT Center in San Francisco at 7 o'clock, 1800 Market Street at Octavia. We're also joined by Nana Khanna. She's executive director for the Positive Women's Network, a national membership body of over 2,500 HIV-positive women. She was diagnosed with HIV in 2002 and was appointed to President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS in 2010. And you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. If you're living with AIDS and you'd like to share your story, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with people with HIV/AIDS, if you work in the public health sector, what will it really take to raise awareness and really make sure that this basic information gets out there? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have any memories from the movements in the 80s and the 90s, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to Nancy in San Francisco. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say, first of all, I really appreciate this new information that I didn't know about being able to suppress the virus. This is all very exciting. And my story is sort of removed and simple, but I just, you know, I'm in my 40s, and so I was in high school when AIDS first sort of came to consciousness, and it feels to me like the wall coming down, that we have reached the point now where it's no longer this death sentence. I was working in a bookstore in the early 90s, and an old couple came into the bookstore, and I turned to my coworker, who was the first person that I knew who knew that he had AIDS, and I said, "Oh, isn't it funny? We're going to be old people one day. Isn't that just amazing?" And he said, "Yeah, I don't think about that very much." And I, you know, oh my God! I mean, I felt like an idiot. And now here it is. I mean, he's fine. He's alive, and he's going to live to be an old man. And the fact that, and for all of the, you know, the anti-gay sentiment out there, the fact scientifically we have gotten to this point just is overwhelming and amazing to me. And I'm so happy that now it's something that people have to contend with. You know, maybe you don't leave a job because you have insurance, but it's no longer this, like, my life is over and I'm going, you know, and everyone, all of my friends are going to abandon me or things like that. So I do feel like we've come a long way just in my lifetime, and that's pretty exciting to me.
Thank you. Nana?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I want to thank Nancy, you know, for your comments. I think that's really right, and it's really inspiring. And it's also important to remember that, you know, as even though people are living a long time with HIV, not everybody was planning to. And so,
And not everybody still knows that you can. So, for example, you know, for folks who were diagnosed 30, 20, even 10 years ago, they may have thought it was a life sentence. And they may have been sick or had to leave their work for whatever reasons. They may have been out of the workforce. And one of the things that we're really missing today are good back-to-work programs for people living with HIV who want to re-enter the workforce. We basically, and because of the way things have been set up in this country, you know, here in the Bay Area, we're really lucky to have a great set of services and access to a lot of the best quality medical care, the best medication, a really good, a really great formulary on our AIDS Drugs Assistance Program provided by the state. In a lot of other parts of the country, there are many more restrictions, including very severe income restrictions, income eligibility requirements to have access to essential life-saving medical care and benefits. So people literally have not been able to earn more than more than $10,000 a year in some states and still qualify to get their HIV medication. So what that has done is basically effectively created a permanent biological underclass where people living with HIV cannot leave poverty, because to do that means risking losing your medication, losing your housing, losing your access to other kinds of services that you need to survive. And even though the Affordable Care Act has the potential to change some of those things, the Medicaid expansion is being fought in a number of states that are also very impacted by HIV, for example, in the southern United States. Those are the same states where we're having things like the Don't Say Gay bill in Tennessee, issues around comprehensive sex education access, a lot of restrictions on access to abortion and contraception. It's no coincidence that a lot of these things are happening in the same places. And so while the epidemic has changed and people really can live a long time, it's time that our policies change to catch up with that new reality, and that we actually facilitate people being able to re-enter the workforce, people not being penalized or threatened with losing access to health care for wanting to go back to work and wanting to make money.
Sean, what would you add to that? I mean, you tell a really interesting story about what happened when you were diagnosed in 1985. You believe you were positive for several years before that. Your doctor said you had 2 years left. And then you, like so many other people, took some medicine, and luckily you stopped, because you might not be here right now if you continued with the antiviral drug AZT.
Right. Well, when I was diagnosed in the fall of 1985, my doctor, who was a friend, held my hands and he said, "Look, Sean, these days you can have 2 good years left." And that was optimistic. He was being helpful. I subsequently outlived him, but I spent a year basically preparing to die. And then in time, all right, I feel pretty good today. But then as my health did deteriorate in the early and mid-90s, my planning window got smaller and smaller. You stopped going to the annual dental checkup. You stopped buying new clothes. Your expectations, your world got smaller. Your expectations changed. And when combination therapy came out, it wasn't immediately suddenly everything is different, because we had had other drugs that had worked for a while and then they stopped working. So over time, my planning window, as I describe it, got bigger and bigger. But most people getting HIV today, HIV is not the number one challenge in their life. They are dealing with poverty. They are dealing with trying to feed their kids. They are dealing with being with housing or food insecurity. They are dealing with addictions and mental illness. That is where we need to address the epidemic in tandem with these other challenges.
In California, if you don't have health insurance, do you still have access to the medicines?
Yeah, you can get access to medication and treatment, both through the new Affordable Care Act requirements, but even before that, through something called the AIDS Drugs Assistance Program, which is a state-administered program that's actually all over the country, but we just happen to have a really good one here in California.
Okay, so that even though it's across the country, it doesn't apply to every state.
It doesn't apply equally in every state. So there are different income eligibility requirements in every state. We happen to have one of the higher ones here. There are also different formularies, so different sets of medications that are covered, and ours happens to be one of the better ones. And it's no accident that here in California is also where we've had a lot of HIV activism and a lot of people doing this work for a long time. You know, I think New York and California have some of the best programs in the country, and it is in part the legacy of ACT UP and organizations like that and the very folks that Sean is talking about in his book who really were able to make that happen.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Nancy. Let's hear next from Anonymous in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. One of your guests just recently said, you know, most HIV positive patients or individuals, you know, AIDS and HIV is no longer the largest issue in their life. And I think that there are many, many people that it's true that the combination therapy has been very effective and has really allowed them to lead normal lives. But there's also a very, very large group of people who have been very tremendously affected, both physically and mentally, by HIV. And the physical may be causing the mental. I mean, recently they found that one of the proteins on the surface of the HIV actually gets in the nerve synapses and causes excitation as well as depression, which can be affecting the mental mood as well as causing things like neuropathy. These people, they become poor, but is the question, they were poor, they became poor, they're poor and they have HIV, or did HIV lead them to a mental state, to a physical state, where they felt like they couldn't do more, like they were unable to do more, and therefore they became poorer and poorer and poorer? And then once you get into that state, it's true, like your guest had pointed out, if you don't stay in that zone, then you can't get help. And it becomes a kind of a self-perpetuating negative feedback loop. And I think that, you know, particularly young people who think of HIV as a chronic disease, they really need to be aware that there is a large group of people who are very seriously negatively impacted by HIV. It's not just like taking some pills and you're fine and you go about your life. And it's very real.
Well, yeah, thank you for raising that point. Sean, do you want to address that?
That's a very important point. And, you know, too often the messaging around HIV, and particularly HIV prevention messaging, is either at an extreme. It's the worst thing that will happen to you. It's awful, horrible, you know, this kind of like scare tactic, or it's nothing. You take a pill and you just move on and it's no big deal. And it isn't either. What it is a life-changing event. It is a huge life-changing event that is a lifelong health challenge, including with risks that we don't even know yet. We don't know what it means for people to take combination therapy for 20 years. No one's done it. We don't know what the long-term side effects of these things are, the effect on our DNA, the effect on ultimately on reproduction, on interactions with other drugs. We don't know. It is expensive. It is stigmatizing beyond belief. It just stigma. The depth of the stigma and the cruelty that many people with HIV experience is so. We need to convey it is a life-changing event. But if it happens to you, there is still a life for you to lead that can be fulfilling and vibrant and full. Rather than saying it's no big deal, you just take a pill, or your life's over. It's the most awful, horrible thing that can happen to a person on this earth. It isn't that.
Nana, do you want to share what it was like for you when you were diagnosed?
I think that as Sean's saying, it is without question, it is a life-changing event. And I think that it is that for a lot of different people. One of the things that we found is that There was some research that came out about a year and a half ago, actually, that about 30% of women living with HIV in this country who are in care have post-traumatic stress disorder, like diagnosable post-traumatic stress disorder. And I don't think that's any accident. You know, the actual diagnosis of HIV itself is a very traumatizing experience. But, you know, when you think about the fact that a lot of women with HIV are coming from communities that are experiencing many different kinds of traumas on a daily basis, whether it's racial injustice or sexism or violence in our homes or in our communities, really a whole set of things. Sexual violence, another thing that we found in our in the research that we did last year, was that almost three quarters of of the women that we surveyed were survivors of intimate partner violence. And those are, you know, women living with HIV who have more access to a lot of information and resources than the typical population of women living with HIV. So what was it like for me? You know, of course, it was a very traumatic experience. It was really surprising and really shocking. It definitely wasn't something I expected to hear. And it caused me to think very differently about my life and what was important. But it also, I think for women, there's a certain way in which, for example, things that are very tied to an HIV diagnosis, like sexuality, partnership, reproduction, are part of how we identify our social status in the world and part of how we really achieve meaning in our lives. And so many times for people living with HIV, at the moment of diagnosis, that's sort of the first thing that kind of gets taken away and that you kind of have to reevaluate. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important that we focus on some of these laws that really perpetuate the internalized stigma that people living with HIV are facing. You know, because it's not like most people with HIV are just running around, you know, post-diagnosis wanting to go around and maliciously infect people or not disclose out of any kind of malicious reason. It's more because they don't feel supported to do so. Or they don't feel safe to do so. Or they're literally, as Sean said earlier, in situations of violence, as in the case of Cicely Bolden, the young woman in Texas who was murdered by her partner, allegedly, you know, after disclosing, he murdered her. And so we don't really have a society in which it's safe for people to take that kind of action.
And it's not just, the removing these laws. You know, you can remove all these laws tomorrow and the stigma will remain. I think you also have to focus on empowering the stigmatized. And that's what I mentioned earlier in the program about these networks of people with HIV, how incredibly important that was to building resilience and creating community and helping people with HIV find the strength and the support to keep from self-stigmatizing and to deal with a sometimes hostile world.
We have a related question from Robert. What about the double stigma of aging and HIV?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, this is what, you know, a lot of long-term survivors, and perhaps especially so or in a specific way with gay men, you know, who are often living in a culture that so values, you know, physical beauty and youth. And so now to be middle-aged, to have HIV, to have, you know, huge numbers of your friends from your earlier in your life, the friends you expected to grow old with, gone. And, you know, in San Francisco, in the last couple of days, I've heard so much about housing insecurity and people concerned about losing their homes and where are they going to go? They've built their entire lives around a community where they walk out on the street and there's a sort of a mutual caring and love. And they're being pushed out. So these are the things, you know, Nana referred to the post-traumatic stress disorder found in women. I think there's something similar with a lot of men.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, in the last several years, there's been this dramatic increase in cultural production relating to the epidemic, the earlier years of the epidemic, exhibits and books and films. And, you know, I got curious about this, and I looked at when the volume of books and films and so on about the Holocaust kicked in. And it wasn't in the 1940s. It wasn't in the 1950s. It started really in the early 60s and escalated until it sort of plateaued in the 80s. Like you need a certain amount of time from the worst experiences to process that and then maybe start to deal with some grief that had been compartmentalized and maybe hadn't dealt with earlier in life, as well as feeling the compulsion to educate others. And you know, the never again cry resonates with me in the last few years in a way it never had before.
That is Sean Stroob. He is out with a new book about his life and activism within the HIV/AIDS community. It's called Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. Many great stories about Sean becoming the first openly HIV-positive person to run for U.S. Congress, founding PAWS magazine, the leading independent global source of information about HIV, interacting with a lot of closeted politicians in Washington. There's just a lot of really great stories in here. That's on the light side, but it's... I liked that part of your book too, Sean. Tonight he'll be speaking at Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7 o'clock, 1520 Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz. And tomorrow at the LGBT Center in San Francisco, 1800 Market at Octavia. And that's at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for the email, Robert. Let's go next to Julie in Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm in Asheville now. I used to live in California, in Santa Cruz and Berkeley. And what I was thinking about was the difference between, you know, how it is in a place like California, in New York, where I worked in HIV from 1987 to about 2001 and did education prevention work. And, you know, it felt like the center of the world, and it felt like we were in the middle of this huge, horrible Holocaust-type thing. And then things got better. I mean, there's all the issues that you've been talking about this hour, but it receded a little bit, and the quilt became not as this incredible thing that it was when I worked on it. But now, when I've lived in Arizona, when I've lived in North Carolina, it's not that way. There's still a huge amount of stigma. There's still a huge amount of ignorance, and people are still very closeted about what they do. Just a lot of ignorance about HIV in general. And when you live in a place like California, you get kind of, or in the Bay Area for specifically, you get a very different view of what it's like, and it's, you know, the rest of the country is not there. You know, it's still back 20 years in how they're dealing with HIV a lot of times. I just want to make that comment, that's all.
Okay, thank you. Do either of you want to comment on that? And can you talk about anything happening in the rest of the country that might surprise us? I'm sure there's so much activism going on in other states that we don't know about.
I think there is, and I think, you know, I want to thank the caller, Julie, for that comment. I think it's really important to understand that, you know, California in some ways really is a bubble, and we're really lucky here. HIV cannot be removed in any way from the conversation around immigration reform, from the racial justice conversation, from conversations about the policing of sexuality and reproduction of women and of LGBT folks. And so in a lot of those places, like in the South, for example, where there are a lot of new HIV infections, and in fact that's where the real emerging epidemic is among women, particularly Black and Brown women, mm-hmm. in the U.S. It is not a coincidence that those are the same places that are, you know, where there are a lot of restrictions on access to medication, access to basic healthcare services, access to sex education, and where there are some of these really terrible laws that are, that criminalize people's, that criminalize sexuality, criminalize exposure, and where you really can't have a lot of the conversations that need to be had to create a supportive environment. But despite that, there are some really great efforts of people organizing. But it's just important to understand that they're organizing in a really different context and often a really hostile environment.
Right. That's just what I was thinking is, well, you know, the caller's point is valid. But you also can find some of the most exciting advocacy in these, you know, places. And I run something called the Cerro Project, and one of our board members, Tammy Haught, is a woman from a rural community in Iowa who has organized phenomenally to seek to modernize that state's HIV criminalization statute, and has really created a network of people with HIV working with public health officials and the media and others. You know, some of Nana's colleagues, you know, Pat Kelly in South Carolina, Wahida Shabazz in Philadelphia, these amazing people out there doing phenomenal organizing work at a grassroots level. It's there if people look for it and want to help and participate. And it's a very welcoming advocacy community as well.
Well, what is also being done to reach, in addition to women, Black and Brown men? Because this New York Times article was pretty disturbing in December. It says the AIDS epidemic is rapidly becoming concentrated among poor young Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men. Despite years of progress, new infections remain at 50,000 a year. More and more of them in these men, who make up less than 1% of the population, Washington, a lot of advocates were quoted as saying there are no models out there for them. There wasn't even an ad campaign aimed at young black men until last year. Krishna Stone said, what is this about? She's with the Gay Men's Health Crisis.
Sure. Well, you know, you can't underestimate the importance of the sex education people are getting, or rather are not getting. I'm 55 years old and grew up in the Midwest in a fairly small city. I got better sex education in junior high school and in my Catholic Jesuit boarding school than most kids coming out of high school today. Mm-hmm. And kids of color are far more likely to be getting abstinence-only sex education, which we now know results in increased unwanted pregnancies, increased sexually transmitted diseases. So the HIV prevention is a mess. We spend only a very tiny amount of the overall prevention dollars focused on where the epidemic mostly is. Two-thirds of the new cases are among gay men and men who have sex with men. I think it's only about 3% of the prevention dollars are targeted specifically to that segment. Prevention messaging these days is very often shame-based or fear-based, which is not doing anything to slow the spread of the epidemic. I actually believe it is doing the reverse. It pushes the people whose behaviors we are trying to modify further and further away. And there's not a supportive gay community that is accepting this epidemic as a collective responsibility. Young gay men who get diagnosed today are really kind of on their own, and they are judged much more harshly than in years past.
And in our last 30 seconds, what will it take to change this? Nana?
I think, leadership by the most impacted communities is always critical. And so, you know, you were asking about response among young black and brown men who have sex with men, for example. Well, you know, it's really important that we support and uplift leadership in and by those communities, and that funding and resources go to them. And if the CDC is developing a prevention campaign, that they go directly to the communities that are most impacted and get their input about what the messaging should look like, and do it in a way that is non-stigmatizing, non-shame-based, and affirming.
Meaningful involvement of the people with HIV in the development of policy and programs.
Sean Strub is author of the new book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. He'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz tonight at 7 o'clock, 1520 Pacific Avenue, and tomorrow at the San Francisco LGBT Center at 7 o'clock, 1800 Market at Octavia. And Nana Khanna is executive director for the Positive Women's Network. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much,
Thank
Rosa.
You very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the Super Bowl, the most watched sporting event in the U.S., with advertisers paying up to $4 million for 30-second spots. We'll also talk about the Brazil World Cup protests and tens of thousands of migrant workers organizing in Sochi, Russia. We'll be joined by the nation's Dave Zirin and the Washington Post's Kathy Lally. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.